Accession number 18702, Reel 1.
Peter Hughes, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Wombwell, near Barnsley.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Wombwell?
Oh no, I was only there for the first 6 weeks of my life because my mother's parents were there, and that is where I spent my first 6 weeks and then returned to Cheshire.
Returned to Cheshire?
My parents' home was in near Ellesmere Port, actually, yeah.
Did you go to school in Ellesmere Port?
No, I was only a young baby there.
So where did you go to school?
My first school was in Egbeth in Liverpool.
And how old were you when you left school?
About 15 and a half.
So which year was that?
1939.
Just before the war started?
Yeah.
And what happened to you on leaving school?
I went to be a chemist, an apprentice chemist, with at that time it was Timothy Whites and Taylor, and then I was transferred to Thompson and Kappa, then back to Timothy Whites and Taylor's in Birkenhead, because the Liverpool branch was bombed out in Liverpool, Thompson and Kappa. And from there I used to do quite a bit of relieving for various branches in the area as a 17-year-old, you know. And then I volunteered for the RAF, actually, for a pilot, and went to Padgate for my tests.
Which year is this?
This would be 1942.
What about the period 39 to 42? Were you in any bombing by the German Air Force?
Oh yes, here in on the Wirral, in Liverpool and Birkenhead, we were bombed extensively, and smoke screens put up to cover the fact that the river was there. Yes, and bombs, a lot of damage was done in Liverpool, and the place that I worked was completely gutted, and that was the reason I was transferred to Birkenhead.
What was your address during the bombing?
Kingsville Road in Higher Bebbington.
Did any bombs fall in your immediate vicinity?
200 yards away. A house was completely demolished, yes.
Which street was that in?
Holmville Road.
Did you use the shelters?
Yes, we had an Anderson shelter which we erected actually in our front room, in the front room of the house, which we used to sleep in, yeah.
What was that like to dwell in?
Well, it was comfortable. We had a few incendiary bombs dropped in our garden as well. We went out and extinguished. Apart from the bomb 200 yards away, it was not too bad, but there was a lot of aerial activity and guns being fired, you know, anti-aircraft guns.
Did any bombs fall near your place of work?
Well, where I was in Thompson Capper in Lord Street in Liverpool was completely bombed out, and this was the reason I moved to Birkenhead. And I think obviously I used to have to go night watching. Do we call it night watching?
Fire watching,
yes, that's right. At night we used to play snooker in a place, fire watch at the same time. And there's quite a lot of activity, really, you know, bombing, fire bombs, incendiary bombs, I should say. I think we did it one night a month or maybe once a week. I can't honestly remember how frequently it was.
How frightened were you in the bombing?
I was only 16, 17 then. And yes, we didn't like it. Not at all. Particularly when the bomb dropped very, very near to us. That was horrendous. The rush of air as the bomb coming down was pretty horrendous. Yeah, we were all concerned. Yeah.
How did public morale stand up in the Blitz?
Fine. Yes, I used to go to work every day on the buses and the boat over to Liverpool, sometimes on the train. And yes, everybody was carried on, really doing everything that they had to do, excepting myself. When my Thompson Capital was bombed, I had to transfer to another branch of the company.
Did you ever think the Germans might win the war?
Never thought of it at all, no.
Did you ever listen to Churchill's broadcast?
Oh, yes.
What effect did they have?
Well, I think they were a moral booster. I think they were. And no, I never thought we'd lose. No, never.
And Lord Haw, did you listen to him?
I've heard him, but we used to laugh at him, didn't we? Yeah.
Sorry, you were telling me about in 42 you volunteered for the RAF. Why was that?
Well, all my friends were joining up and I was too young to be called up, and I would like to have been in the RAF with my friends and obviously a pilot. So I went to Padgate and took all their tests, and physically I passed most of them, excepting the eyesight one. And they said to me that I could not be a pilot because of my eyesight, but I could be an observer. And my attitude to that was I didn't want to sit in the middle of a plane pushing pens and drawing. So they said to me, what do you want to do? So I said, I'll go in the tanks instead. And that's how I happened to. They transferred me into the army.
Still in 1942?
Yes, in 1942. I actually joined the forces on the 3rd of September 1942. Which was a few years after the war broke out.
Where did you do the basic training?
Satan Camp at Chester, followed on by Catterick. And I finally joined my regiment, the 47th Royal Dragoon Guards, at Keighley in Yorkshire.
What did you think of the training that you got?
Oh, I thought it was fabulous. I enjoyed all the training we got, particularly the initial part. I had always been able to drive a car, but we had to learn how to drive heavier vehicles and tanks, and I enjoyed it very much. I loved it, and I loved to have the crash type gearboxes, because you had to be pretty good to change gear, you know, revving and double declutching and all this sort of thing. And also we trained on Crusader tanks, which had epicyclic gearing for steering, which was worked by air compression. And if you were not very, very careful, you pull the lever to the left and there's a valve, and in between the two positions of the valve, the other track would gather speed. Instead of going to the left, you go immediately to the right. Which was a horrific, you know, horrific thing to do. So anyway, after a while, we transfer it from Crusaders to Valentine tanks, which was a very small tank. But they were beautiful to drive, and we sat right in the middle with a gear sticking between our legs, and it was a beautiful little tank, diesel engine, good, very good. And one time on tank training, there was a little rise in the ground, and came down straight into a tank ditch. This is all on training, you know. And one time in Suffolk, towards Thetford, we were doing another training session, right night driving, and I was driving, we were singing on the intercom, and suddenly this guy, whoever he was, I don't remember, he said, for God's sake, Pete, hard left, we're going over the side of a bridge. I don't see it, because we really were driving all the time, following the red light in front of us. You understand me? Anyway, got away with it. And it didn't really concern me at all. When you're 18, you don't worry quite so much as you do when you get older. So I accepted it. But when we were at Keighley, we were then informed that the regiment had been chosen, or the brigade which was in, which was the 8th Armour Brigade, had been chosen to prepare for training for an assault brigade, and we were to be supplied with swimming tanks. First of all, we trained on Valentines, which had twin propellers at the back, two propellers in the water, and at the side of the tanks we had air pillars, which were blown up by compressed air and then held in situation by metal steel struts, which supported the screen, which was around, it was probably about 10 foot high, and when the tank sank, the top of the turret was probably level with the water, and there's only about 2'6" above the water showing, right? It was worked on displacement of water. And this we practiced for a long time. And then we had to also learn how to use Davis submarine escape apparatus in case the tank went down. And in actual fact, at Fritton, I think he's Suffolk again, we had a large tank with a Valentine tank at the bottom of this tank, and we had to get in after a lot of training previously to learn how to use the escape apparatus. We then had to get into this tank at the bottom of a tank with 3 meter wide tubes with which the water was allowed to come in. And we had to sit in the tank in position, in the driver's seat or wherever, and wait until the water stopped coming in. And while the water was coming in, of course, we had to put a nose clip on, mouthpiece, and let a small amount of air into our bottle. Not a lot, because the aperture to escape from was only 12 inches square. And if you had too much in, you couldn't get out. And the first time I did it, everything went fine, and I got out of the tank, escaped from the tank, and they put about 50,000 gallons of water onto us. And I got out, and the very first time I did this, I then had to put more oxygen into the bottle and turn the little knob to do this, and there's no more oxygen in the bottle. So then, against all the rules and regulations, I swam to the surface, you see, instead of allowing myself to be brought up by the oxygen in the bag. And when I arrived on the surface, Brigadier Prior Palmer was there, and the instructors helped me out, obviously. Then he started shouting at me. This was Brigadier Prior Palmer, of course, and he was rather annoyed because I had not obeyed all the sequences we were supposed to follow. And he said, "Man this and man that, why do this, man," and all the rest of it. And I just said nothing. And finally he said to me, "Why did you do it?" And I said, "Sorry, but I had no oxygen." So he then turned to the sergeant instructor and said, "Check this man's bottle. If there's oxygen in it, he's on a charge. And if there isn't any in it, give him a fresh bottle. He goes straight back down again," which I did the whole thing properly. A short time afterwards, he was watching us all do this procedure, and he thought he'd have a go himself. And I was 18 year old, he was probably about 50, I don't really know. So he got the kit on and had a go himself, and 5 minutes later we were fishing him out of the water, unconscious. Stop. Okay. After this trial at Fritton, we were then travelled all over England, really, and down to Gosport and Poole, where we practised assembling on landing craft and going to the middle of between the pool and the Isle of Wight, and we used to land on the Isle of Wight at night on red lights. And all I've ever seen, even to this day, are those red lights on the beach in the Isle of Wight. Sorry. This we did maybe 20 times over a period of 12 months or so. But one time we had an exercise which was at Studland Bay, and the Sea Squadron, which I was a member of, was on this exercise, and the weather became, I think, about a force 5 or 6 gale, and they didn't call off the exercise because of the weather, so we had to proceed. And we lost that night 6 tanks and 6 of the Sea Squadron crews, and I believe there's 5 of the tanks have been blown up because of a danger to shipping. There's 1 remaining, and it remains there to this day. And so we continue with all our training right up until a fortnight before D-Day, when we were transferred to a camp which had been specially prepared for us at Fawley, which is right on the edge of the river. And we were there probably a fortnight before D-Day, and we were surrounded by barbed wire and all the people. It was a hospital, not a hospital, it was a hotel system where we did nothing but eat, go to the mess for meals. We did nothing at all, and just waited for D-Day to come. Sorry. And then, of course, the landing craft came along and picked us up. We got about 6. I don't really remember how many tanks were on each landing craft. And we went into Solent and waited our turn. We'd know that we were there on the 5th of June, ready for the 5th of June, but it was postponed until the 6th because of the weather. And it was quite a good crossing, really. Thousands of ships, lots of aircraft. And we made the crossing in good time. And we landed on the beach at La Riviere at 7:30 in the morning.
On D-Day itself?
On D-Day itself, yeah. And we landed with, my C squadron had the East Yorks with them, and the B squadron, I think, had the Green Howards. This was, I keep forgetting the beach, was it Red Beach or Gold Beach? I can't just remember. But we landed at La Riviere and captured Crewe the first day. The opposition on the beach was not too bad, really. I think we lost more tanks with snipers, people with snipers. We lost 2 people with snipers in C Squadron, and a couple of tanks in the shell holes went down and swamped themselves because they'd let the skirts drop to wade in after swimming maybe 300 or 400 yards. We actually could have swum in 2 or 3 miles, but we didn't do such a long swim as that. It was probably only 500 yards. I can't really estimate how far it was. The actual landing at La Riviere was not too bad, and we cleared the beach. It took us maybe a quarter of an hour, so we got off and basically went 4 or 5 miles in. I remember crossing a railway line, but God knows where that was. And then we had a point where we were heading for, but we didn't quite make it. I think we were about 2 miles off our objective. But because it was getting late in the day, we decided not to go any further and bivvied for the night.
What was your job in the town?
Well, I was a gunner, I was a driver, and I was a co-driver. And I was not fixed, because I was a gunner in my first tank. Then when you were not lost the tank, you went back as a makeup crew, and then you could be anything, whatever they were short of.
And what rank did you have then?
I was only a trooper all the time, yeah.
You said you were in C Squadron. Which troop were you in?
Well, originally I was in with HQ troop and with Major Bell. But then my first tank loss was in second troop, who was... I was with a Sergeant Tees, who was killed, and a John Bishop, who was taken prisoner. And the name of the place we were knocked out at was a little village called Jerusalem.
Well, we're jumping ahead a little bit. Let's just go back to where I interrupted you with D-Day night. You said you bivouacked.
We bivouacked for the night, yes, 10 o'clock-ish. And we had to refuel, more ammunition, feed ourselves, cook for ourselves. And I always remember the first morning that I was lying in the sleeping bag at the side of the tank, and a plane came over, and this big bomb came tumbling out of it and landed in the field next door, next to where we were. In actual fact, it wasn't a bomb, it was an empty petrol tank from one of the planes. But we didn't know that until it hit the ground, of course. And we didn't even know it was one of our planes, because it's going enfilade across crosses, really. That was quite an experience, really, yeah.
Had the amount of enemy opposition when you landed on D-Day been what you had expected?
No, it was less. We did capture a number of prisoners, and they, I always remember one of the guys saying they looked like slit-eyed, he termed them as, Oriental, not Oriental, Asian types. But I don't honestly know what sort of people they were. We didn't. We passed all the prisoners. Were always taken by the, really taken over by the infantry.
And who was in command of your tank?
At that time, it was Sergeant Tees, who was killed, and Bishop was taken prisoner, and three of us escaped.
So we're now onto the D-Day plus one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Can you take me through what happened next, please?
It's very difficult. The gaps between are not easy, because we seem to be up early, 4 o'clock in the morning, and sitting in the tanks and moving forward, helping the infantry and one thing and another till about 10 o'clock at night. And differentiating what we did and what days is not easy to remember, because it's... For about a fortnight, it seemed like a fortnight, we did nothing else but sit in tanks and were in action all the time. And during this time, this first fortnight, I don't know, I lost my first tank 2 or 3 days after D-Day. The second one I lost, I really can't say how long it was after D-Day.
Can you take me through the tank losses one by one in detail and how they happened, please?
Yes, I can. I did make a list of them, but it's difficult to remember always. The second tank, yes. Well, the first tank, as I said, was Sergeant Tees was killed and John Bishop was taken prisoner, and we were making our way back again to our own lines. And I was in a ditch, actually, and our own tanks were coming back making another attack, because we to try and rescue us, I think, and they were coming back and firing in the ditch where we were. And, of course, we kept down until they passed and then up and away into a little lane where I found a German tank burning away and people, bodies lying around. And I saw this guy lying on the ground with a sort of an American helmet, which we were issued with, but we never wore them at all. We just wore our berets. And I looked at this guy, and it was our medical officer who was killed on that day. His name was Captain Hood. And I went further along. There was a lot of firing and smoke and flames, you know. And I got to the side of the farm and took my beret off when I saw one of our tanks, took it up and waved to it, and a hand came through the top of the turret and waved to me to go forward. And when I got to the side of the tank, they opened a little flap at the side and said to me, "Stay there, Pete, there's a sniper in the farm. We'll put a smoke screen down for you and then you can jump into the tank, you see." So I waited for about 5 minutes and then I jumped into the tank and landed on top of the medical officer's orderly. I always remember him because he had a tash, a little moustache. And I, at that time, I couldn't speak. I was so dry. And when you've been on your own in a situation like this, I mean, I don't know what happened to the other two guys. They must have taken a different route to me. But when you've been on your own, you sort of restrict your breathing. So that, I suppose, so the enemy don't hear you. and all I had was a pistol. Wasn't likely to do very much good with it. But anyway, I got on into the tank, and finally we reversed and went back to the main road and maybe a couple of miles back and bivvied for the night. Major Bell came along and asked me if I was okay, and said you'll probably go the rest of the war and never see lose any more tanks, you see. And that was trying to build my confidence up. But he was a nice guy, Major Bell. We thought a lot of him.
So where was the tank lost, do you know?
Jerusalem, a little village called Jerusalem. There's a little cemetery there now.
And do you know what had hit you?
No, I haven't got a clue. No, I don't really know. It's just, I would suspect the track was blown off, really. But I honestly don't know. It was one big noise, you know. You really don't know.
And you just bailed out?
I just bailed out. Five of us got out, actually. But afterwards, the Sergeant Tees and the other guy, I don't know how they came to be captured, and Sergeant Tees was actually shot by the Germans. But I don't know why. We were all safely out of the tank, but this happened after. And I don't really know why.
What time of day was it?
Oh, I'd say it was probably three or 4 o'clock.
And you were uninjured?
Yes, completely.
How shaken were you?
Oh, I don't think I was too bad. I was a little bit. I think the worst part was being on my own, and with all the smoke and seeing the medical officer there and jumping into the tank onto his medical officer. And not being able to, I was so dry and thirsty, that was a real problem, getting a drink. And then later when we pulled back into the bivvy, Major Bell came to see me and see how I was, and I was okay. And a couple of days later I was back in action into another tank.
What kind of a tank was the first one?
Sherman. Sherman tank, yeah.
Can you tell me about what happened on the second occasion?
The second occasion, I think, was an attack around Tessel Woods. And I was put into another crew, of course. And thinking back, each of the four tanks, every time I was in a different troop. And there were five troops in the squadron, and each troop took each day we had a different troop, which was going to be the leading troop for that day. And each time I seemed to lose a tank, I seemed to be found myself into the leading tank for that day. You understand me? And then this, I don't know what troop it was anymore, but it was a young lieutenant in charge. And 8:30 in the morning, we were the leading tank again, and poked our nose into a field, and woof, it happened again. And again, this particular time, there were no actual casualties at all. But I do remember I was sitting right at the front of the tank, and I don't know whether I was driving it or the emergency driver, but I do remember the crew got out so quickly, and I had to weave my way through the turret to get out, you see. And when I came to put my head out of the tank, the Germans were machine gunning the tank itself. So I remained where I was, went back to the front of the tank where there's an escape hatch, released the escape hatch, and it dropped into about 6 inches of water. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. So I went back again into the turret of the tank and waited and waved my berry to see if anything would happen. Nothing happened, so out I came as well to the back of the tank and scooted back into along the hedge to where the infantry were. And all the